And they thought this might suggest that the government of Venus is not very stable.
Or maybe they're just party animals.
Maybe they're just party animals. Well, it's like... This was not a term that had been coined in the 1800s, however.
Probably is a modern term. And who was that fellow who observed the, quote, canals on Mars and postulated that there were Martians?
Schiaparelli or somebody?
Yes, that's right.
And that was Percival Lowell, because Schiaparelli called them canali, which means channels. Not canals. But of course, canali looks like canals to an English person. And I think Percival Lowell in Arizona thought, ooh, there must be Martians if they've got canals. And he, of course, became permanently fixated on there being canals. So he looked at Mars, and everywhere he could see anything that looked like it might be one, he draws a straight line. Because, of course, people build canals in straight lines. So he had this... This is a very good example of where science goes wrong, where you get a fixed idea... And you do everything you can to prove that it's right, rather than questioning it. And of course, there's no such thing as canals on Mars. There's dark patches, which are the...
They're canyons, and they're really deep canyons.
But they're not the things that show up as dark. It's actually the raised parts which are dark.
That's right.
Wow. And the other one, of course, which has been picked up in the popular circles, has been the face on Mars, hasn't it?
Yes.
Fortunately,
amazing what you can do with shadows and lighting properly, you know.
And a blurry camera.
That's right.
Well, you can do all sorts of things, blurry cameras.
But you know, the amazing thing is we can get photographs of Mars. Imagine that. Try and telling your grandparents that I'm going to go to Mars and get photographs from there.
Yeah. And I never cease to be amazed by those little rovers chugging away across the surface. How is it, 4 years or so?
They're still going.
Well,
built for 90
days.
Built for 90 days and
right.
Still going on.
They're well past their warranty period. So let's that's fascinating. So another person, of course, which we greatly revere is Carl Sagan. And he died in 1996, born in 1934. And he was an astronomer and an exobiologist. And
He's often known as the father of astrobiology, the field that I'm studying in. And his contribution not just to science of astrobiology, but human understanding of society is significant. I mean, the documentary series Cosmos, it must be millions of people would have watched it, if not billions, and continue today.
And he looked at the surface of Venus as well, didn't he?
He did a lot of things.
Seasonal changes on Mars. And
he was working at JPL, wasn't it? Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which does a lot of the space probe stuff to the planets.
I mean, he was deeply... In fact, we're celebrating the next year the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the first exobiology experiment by NASA. And that was called the Wolf Trap experiment, which would go and detect life on Mars. Eventually, that instrument specifically didn't go to the Viking missions.
Yeah.
But they had something similar that when the results are inconclusive, it's probably not life that it found, but other chemical reactions.
So this is where they took the sample of the soil and they mixed it with...
They mixed it with new ingredients. Essentially, they gave it some food.
Yeah.
And they waited to see if methane would be released, so to see if microbes were living there. And it was released, but the problem was that they sent three different experiments.
Yeah.
Two of them did not give a positive result, that is, there is life on Mars, and one of them did. Looking back, and people have been looking back since then, even today, and the scientific consensus is that it's probably not life on Mars, but the reaction in the soil itself.
It's just a chemical reaction.
That's right.
Highly oxidized or something like that. There was peroxides or something. Unexpected reactions which caused the same thing to happen, which they hadn't anticipated. So the experiments were not designed to differentiate between life and a natural occurring or inorganic reaction.
Now, I did read a really interesting short story once, and these people are wandering around the back streets of New York, and out of the sky comes this garbage bin looking thing. And it's an alien probe.
Did it have two eyes or three eyes? Oh, probe, you said.
A probe.
Ah.
Yeah. This is fiction, right? And the aliens operating this probe are looking for a certain form, all the signatures of life, which they recognize. And the little instruments are scanning around the place and there's nothing here. and then some backstreet boys take a crowbar to this thing and prize it apart and go, well, that looks like useful for spare parts. We'll see what we can get for that.
They should have fed the thing something like Coca-Cola. That would really confuse it. Now, is that a sign of life or not?
Yes. Sagan also, did he write that novel about the
Contact?
Contact?
Yeah, but Contact. But was there also one about the Dark Cloud? Well, I might be thinking
no, the
about
Dark Cloud. That's Fred Hoyle.
That's Fred Hoyle. Yes, Hoyle. You're right. I'm thinking of Hoyle.
Which was a very interesting book. I remember it's one of the earlier science fiction things. Fred Hoyle was both a very interesting cosmologist. He actually had a lot to do with the first studies of how elements are made in stars, and he then went on to looking at how the universe formed, because the thing was that the universe was expanding, which was this had been discovered. Einstein tried to prove it, because he didn't know it was expanding. He had to tinker with his theories in order to make it not expand.
He had to fudge it with this cosmological constant.
Exactly, he had to fudge it. So where was I? I've lost my track of thought. That's the trouble with
Fred
this business.
Hall, yeah. Fred Hall believed right to the end that it was a steady-state universe, they called
it. What happened was that he couldn't believe in the Big Bang. For another scientist going off the track because he didn't like an idea. And
in fact,
he thought
the word Big Bang was coined by Fred Hoyle as cartoon physics.
as a pejorative term, exactly, but it stuck. But anyway, he suggested the universe was expanding for one reason or another, and it filled itself up by little bits of matter suddenly popping into existence, which is another interesting thing because dark energy is doing that, as it turns out now. So Fred Hoyle invented the steady-state theory, which he believed in passionately for a very long time, until it was finally proved by Penzias and Wilson, who got the Nobel Prize for discovering the faint hiss. They were studying noise in a communications antenna in New Jersey, and this thing had a hiss in the background. They thought, "Oh, why can we get rid of that damn noise?" And they tried to find out all sorts of possible causes, like bad soldering joints. And they went and resoldered everything. And they thought,
"Don't forget the pigeons.
Might be pigeon poo on the antenna." So they cleaned all that off, but it still hissed. And they suddenly realized that they had discovered the signature of the Big Bang, the faint last echo which was originally a brilliant flash of brilliant light and ultraviolet, and that it was so extended by the expansion of the universe that it had become dim microwaves.
Now, as I understand it, by sheer chance, there was an astronomer working nearby who was actually looking for the glow, and these blokes happened to rock up on his doorstep and say, can you help us with this? And he went, well, as it happens.
Yes, but it was the two engineers from Bell Labs who got the Nobel Prize nonetheless.
So you talk about expansion of the universe, because that kind of taps into this other one that occurred this day in science. This is the first US person to get the Nobel Prize for Physics, and it was Albert Michelson.
Michelson,
thank you.
A famous Michelson-Morley experiment, which is used to torture all first-year university students.
I don't know if they still do it or not. You know, maybe it's too old. Maybe. It's assumed knowledge. You should be born with that kind of knowledge now.
I think it's sort of you get it in osmosis in the schools these days. Now, the thing was, of course, that they discovered that light became like waves, behaved like waves, among other things. And they thought, well, if there's a wave, it must be something that's going up and down, like water waves. I mean, you see waves in the water, but there's water there to make the waves. Well, I thought there must be something in there that allows waves to vibrate. And the thought was, there must be something. Well, what do we call it? We can't see it there, but we'll call it the ether. So they invented this imaginary stuff called the ether, which was the basis on which the light waves went up and down. And the way waves behave is if you're moving through the ether or the anything with which has got waves in it, you'll notice that the waves bunch up if you're going towards them, and if you're going sideways, they have different signatures depending which way you're moving compared to the medium in which the waves are occurring. So I thought, well, if we look at light waves at two different directions using this a thing called an interferometer, we should be able to detect a difference in the speed of light depending which way we look. And the net result was that Michelson didn't find this at all. And they said, well, that looks like that put paid to the idea of the ether then, doesn't it?
Well, that's interesting, because I think the last time I did Fuzzy was the anniversary of Doppler.
Which, of course, is what they were sort of looking for.
And what he did was he had a trumpet player on a train, and he had also had one on the station, and he compared the pitch as they went past, and he went, as the train went past, blowing the trumpet. And that's the Doppler shift.
Exactly. The same thing happens. And, of course, that's the explanation of why the Big Bang has now
gone from ultraviolet
to microwave, because it's the universe is at the distance which the Big Bang, edge of the Big Bang is from us now, is moving away at such a high speed that it's stretched out. It's gone from wee down to brrr, only much more so.
4 degrees, is that right?
Above average. 2.73
Kelvin.
2.7.
Which is pretty cool, considering it was originally 2,000 degrees.
Wow. Well, so that's probably a good point at which to get you to describe some of your work, David. I mean, how is it that you got into this field of astronomy?
Well, I blame it on a mole, actually, one of the little animals that dig holes in the ground. Many years ago, my father was working in London. I actually was born in Australia, but we were in London, and I was about 9, I think. And the family was invited out to stay, so visit some friends outside London, because the sky in London even then was horrible. You could, you know, see the very brightest stars. But we went out into the country anyway, and we got there during the day, and they had a nice big lawn, and there were holes in the lawn, and they said, yes, these holes are caused by this mole, which keeps turning up and digging holes in my nice lawn. So I thought, well, this is amazing. I've never seen a mole before, and I looked down the holes, and it was just dirt. So we went into dinner, and I said, can I go outside, please, and have a look for the mole, which was, by this time, it was nighttime. So I went out and looked around, and there's no sign of a mole at all. But then I happened to, you know, oh, pity, there's no mole. I looked up in the sky. It was amazingly dark, and it was, to quote Dave from 2001, it was full of stars. I'd never seen so many stars in my life. I just looked up at it and said, well, something equivalent to, wow, that's amazing. And I've never forgotten the feeling of awe that I had felt when I was 9.
And so, that is an amazing sensation. Do you get that feeling, Addy, when you look up into the sky?
I certainly do. In fact, I get it every time I sleep, because I've got glow-in-the-dark stars all littered through my room. And wow. Every time I switch off my lights at night, I look at it and I go, wow.
That's another thing we have in common, because I did that when I was in college back in Canada.
Yes.
So now, what in particular is your field in here?
I'm studying dwarf galaxies. Now, galaxies, the Milky Way is a big galaxy, and the Andromeda Galaxy, which people have seen pictures of, is a big one as well. They're about equally big, and they're huge. But if anybody's gone out, particularly this time of year, in the early evening, particularly away from streetlights, you may have noticed two little patches of light which look like bits of broken-off Milky Way. Mm. Well, they're the Magellanic Clouds. They are actually little satellite galaxies of the Milky Way, or at least we think they're satellites. They're about between 100 and 200,000 light years away, which means they're quite a way away. But they're probably in orbit by around the Milky Way, and they're probably being torn to bits by the Milky Way by tidal forces. Anyway, the smaller of the two, and they're named after Ferdinand Magellan, who, although he wasn't the first to see them, it was actually recorded, first time it was recorded was by an Arabic astronomer in the 10th century.
So can they be seen in the northern hemisphere too, or is that only southern?
You can see them, but only up to about 10 or 15 degrees north, mm-hmm. I think you can see them from places like Trinidad and in the West Indies and in the north of Africa. But the Arabs, of course, were far enough south. And in any case, the Earth's orbit axis has changed slightly, so it's moved things further south than they were. But anyway, these two things, these little fuzzy patches, which you will see on any really clear, dark night. And if you go down the coast away from the streetlights of Batemans Bay, you'll see them.
Oh, and you can see them from Canberra.
Oh, yeah, very easily, every night. In fact, if you go out tonight, if it's clear, and if you're away from the immediate streetlights, you'll see them. Anyway, the smaller one of these is, they're both dwarf galaxies. They're about, thousands, a thousand or so times smaller than the Milky Way. And the ones I'm looking at are smaller than the smaller of these two. These things are little, they're sort of nearly failed galaxies. They're just enough to have stars in them and gas and stuff like that. But what they do, the thing about small galaxies is that they create stars much more slowly than big galaxies. The difference is a bit like comparing Beijing to Bangendore. Beijing is big, it's polluted, there's not much evidence of its early structure because they've ploughed up all the old buildings and they've built new ones. So this and it's
too messy.
It's huge, and they've lost their sort of archaeological history. Whereas Bangendore still has most of the buildings that were built back in the 1890s or whenever it was founded, and it has low pollution and not much goes on there. And it's, you know, it's a sort of small community and things happen, but happen at a slow and relaxed pace. Whereas Beijing, it's an engine of industry. So I'm looking at the Bangendore type galaxies, which show some evidence of what happened early in the history of the universe, because nothing much has happened since then. They just chug along very slowly, and they tell you about what was happening much earlier in the universe, whereas the same evidence, most of the same evidence in big galaxies has been lost. You can find the odd, strange star, and people do that. People like John Norris up at Stromlo, for instance, look for extremely ancient stars. And you can tell, this is a segue into Addy's work, incidentally, they can tell how old a star is by what sort of elements it's got in it. The early stars, when the universe was first formed, there was nothing in the Big Bang. There was nothing but hydrogen and helium, and maybe a tiny amount of lithium, which is another segue for you. So the first stars formed out of just nothing but hydrogen and helium. And, of course, for various complicated reasons, having to do with something called the Eddington limit or something of that nature, the first stars got very, very big, typically 300 or 400, maybe 500 times bigger than the Sun. And they were huge. They were incredibly hot. They burnt very quickly, and they blew up very violently.
Do you know how long they lasted for?
A few million years only. They were very...
Whereas our Sun is 10 billion years.
And there are stars which are 13 or 14 billion years. Small stars, like small galaxies, do things slowly. Big stars... hot, young, and violent, and they die quickly. But anyway,
sort of the James Deans.
They're the James Deans of the stellar universe. But anyway, so the population three stars. Astronomers are peculiar. The first stars are called population three because of the way they were discovered, not because they were the third. But anyway, population three stars generated a lot of muck when they blew up, and this seeded what hydrogen and helium was still as gas. And the next stars formed from an enriched version of this thing. And what I'm studying is evidence for the enrichment of galaxies due to these first stars. But the more evolution has gone on with stars, the more enrichment there is and the more complicated elements there are available for making stars out of and making planets and making life.
So what we're talking about is the big engines that are making the very stuff of the universe, the matter in the universe.
These things were the first things which generated stuff other than hydrogen and helium. They invented, like my wedding ring, for example, he says, looking down where you can't see on the radio. Every atom in that was forged in the heart of a supernova. They can be made nowhere else. This was formed in the horrendously hot nuclear processes right in the core of this star, which was so big that it collapsed in on itself and blew all its contents out into the surrounding.
So that's quite a sobering thought, so that, you know, you're listening on your radio right now and ourselves in the studio, the chair that's holding me up, the microphone I'm talking to and the computers around me and so on.
And us itself, me too. And
all our blood corpuscles.
And yes, that's a good segue for you, Eddie. Yes. The actual stuff of our bodies was all built inside these big factories, the Big Bang initially, and then the stars themselves and the galaxies.
The stars were the sort of production lines for elements, and the first ones only had limited stuff to work with, them in hydrogen and helium, and then as they enriched the stuff from which new stars grew. I mean, you've seen the Fingers of God image from Hubble Space Telescope for those sort of new stars being born, or the Orion Nebula, where new stars are being born. They're being born from mainly hydrogen, but there's a lot of other elements in there which were produced by previous stars. And stars that are burning, that are growing now from this dust, these dust clouds, they sort of condense like steam, and then they form little lumps which then light up and become stars. These are got much more heavy elements than the early stars. And our Sun is sort of intermediate in age. We use the Sun as a standard candle, sort of stars which have less heavy elements than the Sun, or stars which have more. And all the current modern stars have more.
So what amazes me about astronomy is you run out of words for meaning big.
Yes.
I mean big, you know, bigger and bigger, violent and violent and more violent and words fail because this place is such a energetic and the big whoops that go on out there in the quasars and so on. It's just
the number of stars in the universe, and this is what Carl Sagan used to say, is more than, so there's 10 to the 11th for those mathematically inclined, and I don't pretend that I or anyone else will actually comprehend this number. 10 to the 11th stars in our galaxy. And there are 10 to the 11 galaxies in the universe. And so how do you comprehend that number of 10 to the 22 stars in the universe? Well, Carl Sagan used to say there are more stars in the universe than grains of sand on every beach on Earth.
Yeah.
Go down to Bateman's Bay and have a look at the sand and then think, there's a lot of beaches around here.
There's that scene in the Cosmos series where he holds a handful of sand and he says, yes, there's about 100,000 grains of sand in my hand, and he tips it slowly in front of you.
Yes.
And he says, that's how many, there's more suns in the galaxy, in the universe, mm-hmm, than there are grains of sand in the entire Earth.
That's right. And around each of those suns, stars, there's probably a planet or more going around them, and therefore if life needs a planet around a star, then how many possible habitable zones, planets out there, you know, just amazes.
Well, now if that doesn't depress you at all, or it makes you perhaps feel inspired. We're going to take a quick music break now. When we come back, we're going to talk about lithium in stars and how it relates to planets. And, you're listening to the Fuzzy Logic Science Show here on Radio 2XX. My name is Rod, and in the studio with me are Addy and David from Mount Stromlo Observatory. This is The Violent Femmes. I think there's reference to sun in here somewhere. And you're listening to the Fuzzy Logic Science Show here on Community Radio 2XX. And David's just telling me that we actually have an audience member in Michigan right now. So do you want to say hello, David?
Hi, Judy, if you're listening in Michigan. Judy's my sister-in-law, and my wife emailed her to say we'd be on and pointed out to the live streaming for 2XX.
That's
so
right.
So potentially we've got an audience in Michigan.
So Community Radio 2XX, we do stream live through www.2xfm.org.au, and this show is also podcast on Fuzzy Logic on 2xx.podbean.com.
And while we're in the business of saying hellos, hello to my mom and dad in Perth, and my sister too.
They're listening to live streaming as well.
Too.
Oh,
they
very good, very good.
And they'll keep listening to the podcast again and again too.
My sister Susan and my brother Christopher are also probably listening, as well as my wife Linda, of course.
Well, there you go. We have
hi, Linda.
Now, I mentioned somewhat facetiously the term lithium earlier about being something we take when we're depressed. But actually, David, you were saying that it was formed in the Big Bang.
There's a very small amount of it left, and it's used sometimes as a tracer to see what the original makeup of the universe was, what the Big Bang actually did. And there's ways of distinguishing between different sorts of Big Bang, because I don't really know what went on. But the trouble is that stars have a habit of eating lithium. It gets gobbled up in the nuclear processes. So it's rather hard to know whether you're looking at the primordial lithium or whether it's been made in stars or eaten up by them.
Oh, so there's no signature that it leaves, I presume?
Well, it, you can see it there, but it's a problem to work out what it's telling you. And from what you were saying earlier about these lithium in star atmospheres or lack of it, it looks like it's an interesting one for Addy.
That's right. Well, before we go on to Addy's comments here, lithium has actually been found to be possibly a significant indicator of whether a planet is revolving around a sun, a distant sun. And they found that it is significantly less on the surface than on stars with planets, so that it seems. So we've got about 451 sun-like stars, 70 of which are known to harbour planets. I think it's more than that now, isn't it?
More than probably 474 now or something.
They're finding them like every under every rock they look under, there's planets.
It's amazing.
Back in the good old days of our 10, since what, it's been 15 years since the planet search started or so?
That's right, yes.
And
yes,
back then, every planet you found, there would be a paper that was being published. But these days, every paper contains 10 or 15 planets that they have found because there's just so many being found.
And the journal editors say, oh, no, not another planet.
Yeah, well, but can't they come up with more interesting names? Like, what was this one here? Gliese 4581D.
Yeah. So what the idea behind that is they've named the star Gliese, and 581 is a star. It's in the Gliese system, I guess. And then you have A, B, C, D in the order that they were found. Or if they're found in a group, then it's in the order of how far they are from the star. So, you know, Earth would be C because it's the third one from the sun.
Okay. So there's a bit of speculation here about the lithium. So the story is that there's less lithium visible on these stars, and they're not really sure why it relates to the planet or the existence of planets, but it could be that the planets stir up the surface of the sun. And so you were saying earlier there's tidal forces created on the sun.
What happens with stars is that when stars form, they have this thing, dust, that surrounds them. And eventually it forms a disk, and we call it the planetary disk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's small pieces of dust and small grains. And these coalesce together and form bigger rocks. These coalesce together and form planets. So in the process of forming planets, all the heavy elements like lithium and iron and silicon and aluminum, that what the Earth's crust is essentially made up of, leaves the region of the star, doesn't get sucked into the star, and it's found in the planets.
So the planets kind of vacuum up this stuff and put it into their own mass.
Yeah.
That sounds plausible, I must admit.
And the other extreme side of it is you think of things like hydrogen and helium, because they are light, they are volatile elements, they disappear off the planets because the solar wind is pushing it away, or they're just escaping into space and going in there.
So do you think we know enough yet to postulate what percentage of stars would have planets?
Well, it's ongoing research, but chances are that more stars have planets around them. And there are stars that we haven't found planets around, but that's probably because we haven't looked long enough, or the telescopes and the other techniques that we use to find planets aren't sensitive enough to find all the planets. The interesting question is how many Earth-like planets are out there, habitable ones.
Ah, yes, because I've got a story here about one where they found water, what they think it's water, and they're guessing this because of the density. They think that the density puts it probably in the range where, I don't know how you can guess this, but there's not enough information for me to tell you that.
That's right. And the other thing with water is, of course, you need to be far enough from the star so that it's not hot, that the water boils away within a million years. And it's not far away as such as Mars, where the water is always frozen. You want liquid water.
So that's what they call the Goldilocks zone?
That's right.
A habitable zone is the other.
So this,
I like Goldilocks zone.
Yes, it does. It's just right.
Not too hot, not too cold. Well, this planet is called... we should have sponsors for these planets, you know. This could be the, you know, like the Toyota something or other planet or whatever.
Don't suggest it, please. It's bad enough as it is.
Maybe we should name them after great people. Maybe. Anyway, this one's called GJ1214B, and it represents a major step forward in the search for Earth-like planets because it's got water around it, or water on it.
Does it tell you how far away it is from here?
Yeah, this one is 42 light years away.
Oh, look at that. So the thing is, although we can't travel and find out what it's to live like over there, you know, the movie Avatar's just come out and they visit Pandora, and we can't do that yet, but we can use telescopes and sit here right in Canberra, use our telescopes and find out what's going on over there, which is just amazing.
So what sort of techniques do we use to learn, discover and learn about these planets?
So one of the main ways to do it is to use spectroscopy. And that's, you know, looking at the rainbow spectrum that's coming out, just like when you have rainbow from sunshine and water in the atmosphere interacting. By looking at what colors there are, how strong they are, and what kind of absorption features they have, there would be dark bands in there.
But is this light from the star or from the planet itself? Because they don't emit their own light.
No,
do they?
None of the planets emit their own light. It's always reflected from the star, mm-hmm. but the most interesting planets that we've found are the ones that have infrared emissions. So these are the heat that's coming out of the planet. And every planet will have that. You and me have infrared coming out of us. Mm-hmm. You know, firemen use that when they have their cameras looking for people in smoke.
Yeah.
So they use that, and by measuring the kind of infrared emissions they have, they can find out what elements there are.
So is it not too faint and drowned out by the star itself?
It is.
It's very difficult.
It's difficult, but possible. It's not impossible. There are methods they use. So they'll block out, they call it a coronagraph, where they block out the bright light of the star,
mm-hmm.
and they can just pick out the planet itself.
There are at least, I think, three ways that I can think of offhand how they find things. Firstly, if when there's a planet that goes across the disk of a star, it actually obscures like a small eclipse. It just, this little black spot moves across, and you can, by watching the light of the star, you can just see the effect of the planet obscuring a tiny fraction of the star.
Which is what brought Cook into the Pacific when he was looking for the transit. He was looking at Venus
doing exactly the same thing, but yeah. In this case, the transits are across stars, which we can't actually see.
Stars are far, far away, and you see. So it's essentially a pinpoint that's losing light. I think it's 0.1%.
It dims very slightly. And amateurs are doing this sort of work. It's amazing.
Right.
The second one, of course, is the coronagraph approach, which Adi was saying, which is probably the hardest of the lot until we get really huge new space telescopes. Mm. I think there's one out there now, isn't there?
The Kepler.
Kepler, that's the one. And there's a third method, which is the wobble. If you have a look at the position of a star.
No, I'll correct myself. Kepler is not doing that. Kepler is just transits. But I think there are ones that are going near worlds. I think it's the one.
Yeah, that's the one. I knew there was something. Yeah. And anyway, the third one is the wobble. If you look at the stars, even though very slowly, they do move through the sky. And if you look at the position of the star against the distant stars behind it, you can see its path is actually slightly wobbly if there's something going around it, because it's a bit like sort of a... imagine a hammer thrower, for example. Now, if you make a very heavy but small hammer, the hammer thrower sort of swings around and around. You can see the man moving around, but if you're far enough away, you won't see the hammer. And you'll see this man wobbling, and you can deduce from what he's doing that there's something heavy on the other end of the stick. And you can see small wobbles in the path of the stars, which tells you that there is, in fact, something massive also nearby. Now, more often than not, it's another star, but for a very tiny wobble, it could be a planet, and they've been able to work out the masses by how big the wobble is.
So this is a regular periodic wobble, not a drunk walking down the street.
No, it's like a well-trained hammer thrower before he lets go of the hammer.
Well, there's a little bit of disappointing news here, that NASA had a mission on the drawing board called the Terrestrial Planet Finder.
Mm, that's right.
But unfortunately, it's been deferred indefinitely. But it had a thing called, in fact, it's using the technique you're talking about, Eddie,
yep.
A visible light coronagraph. And it was going to be launched in 2016, but sadly not. And another one was called Planet Quest, a precursor planetfy called SIM Planet Quest, also been delayed since 2015. Yeah. So that's a bit of a shame.
That's the thing with space missions, because they're expensive. What often happens when a project is cancelled is they will use the techniques that were developed for example, for the Terrestrial Planet Finder, and put it in other projects that are indeed going ahead. So recently this year, the Kepler telescope was launched, and that's looking at a patch of the sky and monitors, you know, transits of planets around each star, and it's looking at millions of things. So some of the techniques that were developed for the Terrestrial Planet Finder find their way into other projects. And who knows, you know, in the future, I'm sure there'll be a time when the technology improves and there's more money that's coming in from the government and funding agencies where these projects again become possible.
Well, I think we might break to a track now. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you, Addy, about what stuff makes up our bodies, because I believe that's what your research has been about.
Yes.
What's in our bodies? Where did it come from? Well, stars, of course.
There are we going.
Here, and we're making it on
Biggest
Fuzzy Logic.
Questions of our times.
Here on 2XX Community Radio. This is Ever Longing by Maybe. And that was Everlonging, Moby on Radio 2XX Fuzzy Logic. My name is Rod, and in here in the studio with me, we have two astronomers from Mount Stromlo, Addie and David. And so now, Addie, how did you get into this field? I mean, what drew you into astronomy?
Well, ever since I can remember, I was always interested in science. You see, I was sort of born in a hospital, but I was brought up in a lab because my mom's a scientist too, and I spent a lot of time sleeping and, I guess, doing things in her biology lab. And I was always interested in science. As I grew up, I found I want to do biology, I want to do chemistry, I want to do science. Once you come to high school these days, they will often prescribe to you what you want to do. You know, you can either do chemistry or biology. So I went into university and told the course advisors that I want to do science. Said, okay, what kind of science? I said, I don't know, I just want to do science. It turns out that because of bureaucracy and the way universities work, you have to choose a major. I didn't like that. So I found a way around it. What I did was every semester I would change my majors from chemistry and biology. And that way, by the end of 3 years, I had a little bit of knowledge in everything to do with science, I guess.
Well, you seem to have done a really interesting thing. So you're on the cusp of biology and astronomy, aren't you?
That's right, yes.
So you describe yourself as an exobiologist. So Carl Sagan, you were talking passionately earlier about him.
That's right. Now, exobiologist is one of the things that an astrobiologist does. And I like to call myself astrobiologist because we look at not just the astro part of it, not just the biology that's on Earth, but the chemistry and the physics that connects the two. Because, you see, the physics is the same in the universe, and therefore the chemistry is also likely to be same all over the universe on all these other planets. And therefore, probably the biology also applies around the universe. Specifically, what I'm looking at in my PhD research is finding out the elements that make up life on Earth. Because, you know, you want to find out what is life. One of the ways of answering that question is to look at what is life made of, right?
So you're looking at the, you're profiling the occurrence of elements inside living organisms?
That's is that right, right? Yeah. So if you take a human being, about 95% of our bodies are made up of hydrogen and oxygen, most of it just has water. And then you can add things like carbon and nitrogen and sulfur.
You would have been pleased with us the other day. We had a trivia question on Fuzzy, and we asked which is the most abundant element in the human body.
I heard that one. And the moment you guys gave the answers, I went back to my table and said, does that make sense? And it did. So well done, Rob.
So now what do you do your research? You take a not a human, I presume.
Well, we have to go through a long ethical process to do that. But what we are doing is we take bacteria, really small microbes, and we take them and put them into concentrated acid and dissolve them up, just like the ones you put in your swimming pool. We will then run them through an instrument called a spectrometer, mass spectrometer, which exposes that solution, the dissolved bacteria, to a temperature of about 10,000 Kelvin, which is hotter than the surface of the sun.
Indeed, almost twice as hot.
And that, again, emits those emission lines with each element, and you can get a spectroscopic signature of the abundances, the amounts of each element. And you can do a lot of interesting things with that.
Now, you had a really nice turn of phrase on your website which described what you were finding, and you were saying that primitive forms of life have less abundance or less variety in the elements they use. Is that right?
That's right. So imagine you're a novice chef and you are going into a course and you want to bake a cake. You start with just the flour and, you know, maybe eggs and sugar. And then as you progress along, and you can then start adding chocolate to it and cinnamon and strawberries. And at the end of it, you know, end up with a pavlova. And that's probably, we think life would have worked as well. So back 4 billion years ago when life started on Earth, it could have just used things, the most abundant elements, you know, hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon, nitrogen.
So relatively simple composition, in other words.
That's right.
Now,
and today we have things like iron and copper and all these, you know, we accessorize ourselves with these designer elements, I say.
Now, I see interesting parallels here because what I visualize the universe as being is an engine that generates complexity. And I've seen it with what David has been talking about, how we're generating more and more of the heavier elements through the processes in the suns.
That's right. The interesting thing is that Addie's talking about hydrogen and carbon and oxygen and nitrogen and sulfur and stuff like that being the early elements which life chose as its first ingredients. The funny thing is that I've just come back from Siding Spring Observatory looking at these dwarf galaxies, and they're exactly the same elements that I'm observing in these galaxies. So they were there from awfully long way back. So life has had a tremendously long time to do different things around the universe. And Eddie's looking at what it's actually done here, which is wonderful.
So not a lot of helium you've mentioned. I haven't mentioned helium particularly.
Doesn't do much.
Right. You see, helium can't do much because one of the noble gases, we call them. But the thing is, there's very little helium around. Because it's so light, in fact, you put them in balloons and you send them up into the upper atmosphere. And at Stromlo, we're actually doing one of these things, which is called Earthrise. We'll be putting a balloon. A lot of people might have heard of this thing. Put balloons, put cameras on balloons, and take photographs of the Earth from space. And students at Stromlo are involved with something like that. But the point with helium and things like argon and other noble gases is that because they're so low in abundance, life... if life is to use it, it's really hard for it to get it, and therefore, chances it won't use it.
But I guess, as you suggested, it's not a very interesting quotes sort of element because it can't do much with it. It doesn't combine with anything else.
Yes.
Yeah. So, is there a limit to the richness that does it kind of plateau out when you get to the higher organisms?
Yeah. So there's about 80 stable elements in the universe. We've found about 114. Also elements, but 80 of them are stable, so they occur naturally in the environment, out of which we find that about 25 of them are found in all life forms, that is being used in some life form or the other. So for example, we're using iron in our hemoglobin. Some marine organisms use copper as their oxygen transport. Molybdenum is used by some bacteria. Gold may be used by some things. The thing with abundance in life is that we find things like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, and phosphorus is something that all life uses. And they also turn out to be the most abundant, not just on Earth, but after hydrogen and helium in the universe.
Even in my little galaxies.
That's right. And the rest of them go lower and lower down in their abundance, and therefore life has to be careful about what it uses and how it uses it.
So where do you think your research will go next? What sort of things will you be looking at?
Well, one of the things that I'm looking at is in the future would be to, once you find out how life, what it's made up of, is to find out where it got started. Because you see, if you look at you have a fingerprint, like a DNA fingerprint, you can put a person at the site of the crime. You can do that with elemental fingerprints too, because if we find out what Rod is made up of, we could find out what he had for dinner last night, or we could go all the way back 4 billion years and find out what life had for dinner 4 billion years ago, or indeed in its environment, where its environment could be. So the ideas vary from deep hydrothermal vents. These are these volcanoes down in the oceans, and maybe life started out there. I'll be going to a conference next month. And
so it might actually be a technique for archaeology, paleontology, think?
We call it paleobiology. That's why I just love... astrobiology should be expanded into astrobiochemical phylo... In fact, my PhD title could be called paleo-eco-stochio-phylogenomics. Try saying that 10 times.
After a beer. So I was lucky to have Reno on the show a few weeks back.
Yes.
And he studies the occurrence of uranium in the teeth layers. Deposited. It gets absorbed into the teeth and is very persistent. So he can actually date things based on the occurrence and using stuff like electron spin resonance and other weird things like that.
Absolutely. It's very interesting. And I know Reno, and this is one of the things that happens at ANU. You can do this kind of fundamental science. And that's one of the very few places in Australia where you can afford
it. An enormously rich institution as far as science is concerned, which is one of the reasons why it's one of the top institutions in science in the world.
And it's wonderful, and it's a fabulous asset to allow us to do a fuzzy show as well. So now, I did the adult astronomy course out at Stromlo some years back before the fires. How's the observatory faring after the fires now?
So what happens is, although it's been pretty good, I only came here after the fires, and although there are no research-grade telescopes operating at Mount Stromlo anymore, there are still ones which visitors can go and see the burnt-out remains, and it's a wonderful sight in itself. But most of the telescopes are now located in the Siding Spring Observatories down at Coonabarabran.
That's right, yeah. It's about 6 hours' drive north of here.
And it's turned out good because, you see, with the light pollution increasing in Canberra, there wasn't a lot of astronomy that could be done, research-grade astronomy that could be done over here. And so the observing has moved there, but all the, I guess, the intellectual and the theory side of things still remain up at Stromlo and at ANU.
And a lot of the computing and theoretical stuff, there's some very big supercomputers in ANU and some in Stromlo itself, and the theoreticians are using the ANU's computing resources for doing their work. And of course, they don't need a telescope. But I remember, I was actually up, I was a summer vacation scholar many years ago, long before the... before the fires, and the thing I miss most, is, oddly enough, is the old library. So many wonderful old astronomical records dating back from, you know, 100 years ago or more were completely lost. And the telescopes, well, it's sad to see a hulk where there was once a wonderful telescope, but as Eddie said, they can't really be used anymore because the light pollution from Canberra is atrocious. And I often wonder why anybody lets the lighting engineers put the cheapest lights up, which spray light up into the sky and completely wreck the night sky for anybody who wants to look at it.
Yeah. So that's something I would suggest a lot of people do over Christmas, is just to go away from the city and look at the night sky, and you'll be amazed with what you see. You might see meteors hurling down, you know, meteor strike, or maybe look at the large Magellanic clouds.
If you get up, for instance, around about midnight or a bit after midnight, you'll see a bright orange star rising in the east, and that's Mars.
Yes.
Mars is coming around. Jupiter is a yellowish-coloured, very bright star in the western sky, and you'll see that even in the middle of Canberra. It's very bright.
Okay, and there is a good website I recommend called Heavens Above, and I used it some years ago. I go down to Point Hicks, to the lighthouse there, and it's a fabulous place for watching the stars because it's so remote. And I took the family out and I said, okay, at 6:40, at 10 degrees above the horizon, 140 degrees, we will see a reflection off the space lab, or one of the big
National Space Station.
Or it might have been one of the Iridium.
Iridiums. They're very spectacular. It's dazzlingly bright for just a few seconds.
And there was a bit of skepticism. We all stood on the beach and it was just after sunset and they all looked, you know, over in that direction. All of a sudden, this thing appeared in the sky, and for about a minute or so, there it was.
Yes. And that's quite amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's very spectacular. So if anybody sees this sort of brilliantly bright light in the sky, which moves a little bit over a series of tens of seconds and then disappears, it's almost certainly an Iridium satellite.
But then if you look at the International Space Station, you can often make it, it's visible through its journey through your hemisphere.
And that's a very bright satellite. And Heavens Above tells you where the space station is too. So if you want to go to heavensabove.com, is it?
Something like that. Just look at
Heavens Above.
Heavens Above.
It'll tell you when to look and where.
All right, so we're coming to a close, but David, you were saying that there's an amateur society here if people are interested in astronomy.
Yes, well, people who want to follow up astronomy, who want to ask questions like, how do I find my way around the skies? How do I tell a planet from a star? What sort of telescope should I buy? The best starting point would probably be the Canberra Astronomical Society. It's mainly amateurs, but I'm actually a member of it as well as being what I would consider a professional astronomer, even though I'm a student. But the Canberra Astronomical Society, and I don't know what its website is, but if you just Google Canberra Astronomical Society, you'll find it. They have meetings, I'm pretty sure it's every third Thursday of every month. They have a beginner's session which starts at 7:30 in the evening at the top of Mount Stromlo. You just take this road up. The gate, which is normally closed at night, is open for people to get through. And you go to the, you follow the road all the way up. There's usually cars at that time of night, so you just follow the cars, and it's in the Duffield building, as I recall, not the Duffield, the Woolley building, and they have a special session for beginner amateurs, which teaches you all about the sort of things you need to know, and then you can ask questions, and it's a great place for that, and it's free.
And the internet is another resource that people can just go and browse, you know, the websites like the Astronomy Picture of the Day. You go on there once and you can just find your way looking through the entire archive and spending hours together on it.
It is a wonderful thing, and I've really enjoyed looking back into the very origins of ourselves and this thing we live in, whatever it is that we dimly understand through these telescopes and through people like yourselves.
We are learning, and learning much more than we could ever imagine.
And what we learn most interestingly is what we're not expecting to learn. As I mentioned a bit earlier before we came on air, Stephen Hawking's thesis actually... what he's most famous for occurred, I think, when he was writing chapter 6 of his thesis. He was nearly finished it, and he suddenly had a brilliant idea, and that completely transformed his thesis and his life.
And ours too.
Yes, and thank
you. It all connects.
Well, we're going to see if we can get Stephen Hawking on to Fuzzy Logic sometime.
Let's see.
I'm sure Eddie could program his Dell to do something.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for your time today. It's fascinating to talk to you.
Thank you for having us here.
Anytime.
Aditya Chopra, thank you.
Thank you.
And David Nichols.
You are very welcome, sir.
My name is Rod. You've been listening to the Fuzzy Logic Science Show here on Community Radio 2XX. And tune in. We're going to be going right over Christmas, so look forward to your company then. And have a good break. This is Man Overboard.